turn the lights up. Stan Freeberg is a person you hear with your ears, not your eyes. And sometimes you even want to just close your eyes because you can appreciate it more. Before I start, I just want you to know that there's nothing wrong with the sound system. When you start hearing sounds coming out from here, this speaker, and not this speaker, it's because of my recording equipment, not the playback equipment. Also, before beginning, I'd like to acknowledge the invaluable assistance of two Freeberg collectors, Glenn Bray of California and Ward Irwin of Florida, who helped locate some of the very rare material you're going to hear today. Stan Freeberg, recording artist, satirist, and ad man, a man whose professional career has covered 45 years and whose critics, as Stan says, can be counted on the fingers of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. It's surprising that many people have heard his records and are very familiar with him, but he hasn't released anything since 1968. Yet some of his hits are regularly played on the radio, and you'll probably remember some of these. Share with you today some other released recordings, many of which you've never heard and many of which are very hard to find. I also hope to share the fun of Stan's humor. Life for Stan Freeberg began in 1926 in Los Angeles. He was always performing for his friends in school, and at age 17 he had produced and written two all-student high school stage shows and won three California state tournaments. Upon graduating, he refused a full scholarship at Redlands University in a dramatic contest to begin his career. His presentation was a takeoff on Arch Obler's radio show, with Stan doing all the voices, and as an encore, he did a satire on the Fred Allen Show. While making a radio appearance in Los Angeles, he was introduced to Cliffy Stone, who invited him to visit his radio show. When Cliffy couldn't find people for his Man in the Street interviews, he hired Stan to do all the voices. Later, Stan did the crying portion on Cliffy Stone's record of Wabash Blues on Capitol. After 2 years with Cliffy and 2 years in the service for Uncle Sam, He was hired by such top movie studios as MGM, Paramount, and Columbia for voice recordings on animated cartoons. Next came a countrywide tour as Stan the Man, a guitar and harmonica playing comic with the Red Fox Orchestra. Then on to television. In 1947, he started 5 years of doing with Dawes Butler all the voices for Time for Beanie. He still complains now that Bob Clampett, that did the Time for Beanie show, was, as he says, stupid enough not to video or to film the shows as Lucy did, because he'd still be getting residuals today. He was also on a panel show called Musical Chairs with Johnny Mercer. Last of all came his signing with Capitol Records in 1951 to record John and Marcia, a portion of which you heard, a satire on radio soap operas. He followed this with I've Got You Under My Skin and Television, which you also heard. 1952, as is 1988 in the United States, was an election year, and Stan had his own candidate, Abe Snake. My first selection will be Abe Snake. Following this is Freeburg's plan for how to hold elections, as he explained in the 1976 speech. Stan the starring role in a radio show, That's Rich, but Stan did none of the writing. It was also the release year of his biggest hit, St. George and the Dragonette. Of course, the other side of that was Little Blue Riding Hood, which you heard yesterday in its entirety. By the time he appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show, the record had sold more copies than any in the history of Capitol Records. While writing all his own hits, Stan found time to write for others. Here's a very clever song Stan wrote, but it was recorded by the voice of Bugs Bunny and others, Mel Blanc. In 1956, Stan entered still another arena for his talent. When San Francisco's offbeat ad man, Howard Gossage, hired him to write his first commercial, it was for Contadina tomatoes and asked, who put those eight great tomatoes in the itty little bitty can? Now his talents began to blend. And in July 1957, Stan was given a 15-week series on CBS Radio. Add here that with the exception of one piece you'll hear, all these items were commercially released. This is from one of the Best of the Stan Freberg Show albums. Since CBS could not find any sponsors for the show, Stan wrote all the commercials too. This show has the honor of being the last live network radio show, commercial network, and highlights of the show were released by Capitol as Face the Funnies and Madison Avenue Werewolf, two both very collectible albums. I've chosen not to play other pieces from those because their original source was the show. Following the radio show, he made a concert tour of Australia, and upon returning, married his secretary, Donna. He subsequently has two children, Donna Jr. and Donovan, both working in his commercials. He was married in the service performed by his father, a Baptist minister. 1959 was the centennial for the state of Oregon. As a present to the state, Stan wrote and recorded Oregon, Oregon, a centennial fable in three very short acts. As it was only distributed within the state, it is probably one of Freeburg's rarest releases. Here I'll play for you now Act One of Oregon, Oregon.
Gee, Dad, it's a wilderness.
Yeah, a little timberland goes a long way with me. I'm tired of exploring. I mean, the Oregon Territory is a nice place to live, but I wouldn't want to visit here.
You said it. A tourist wants to come here today, he has to sail around the Horn, blaze a trail in, shoot the rapids, or be born here. You know why?
Why?
No state highways, that's why.
Well, before you have a state highway, you gotta have a state.
Yeah, a territory's great, but you gotta have a state.
Where did that bell note come from?
I hit this triangle I carry around for just such a purpose.
I'll accept that.
A territory's great, but you gotta have a state.
But you gotta have a state, but you gotta have a state. States look good, just like a state should. To have a state highway go through. To have a state fair to go to. To have a big rose hoop-dee-doo. You gotta have a state. A territory's swell, but it doesn't ring the bell.
But it doesn't ring the bell.
But it doesn't. Bachelor's degree to beat the fans of USA.
You gotta have a state.
A territory's fine, but you gotta draw the line.
But you gotta draw the line.
But you gotta draw the line. Lines you use to show who state is whose. They got a most discreet crevasse to separate them half and mass. And if you want that kind of class, you gotta draw the line. Unless you do, you'll have some chap.
Dave, who's going to be around in 1959?
They do get back out of the bottle again, however. Freberg next put records on hold, and he delved full force in advertising. He formed Freberg Limited, but not very, with a staff of only 8 in Beverly Hills, his wife being one. Their motto, which is displayed over the door, is Ars Gratia Pecuniae, art for money's sake, charging $100,000 plus costs per campaign. As a sample of his technique, here's a commercial he did for butternut instant coffee.
Okay, now here's the music, and remember those pear-shaped cones.
Oh, yes, I learned all about those at Juilliard.
Now, never mind Juilliard now. Keep in mind that it's the world's first real instant coffee because it dissolves in 1 second flat. And be sure, are you listening to me? Be sure to get home in the car about how the folks at Butternut worked five, counted 5 long years.
Oh, I'm ready now. I'm really ready.
Okay. No, the butternut words.
Oh, are we doing Madame Butternut?
No, look, this is what I want you to sing. 5 years isn't exactly instant, but that's how long it took to make instant butternut coffee. The first real instant coffee
that tastes like coffee ought to taste. That's what
butternut.
Instant butternut.
Freberg followed this commercial with a 6.5 minute singing commercial for Butternut called Omaha, featuring the Omaha Symphony Orchestra and only incidentally mentioning the product. Capitol released this as a commercial record. While spending most of his time writing commercials, Stan began work on his biggest task, presenting the United States of America, at least on record. Composing all the songs on his guitar, something many people don't know, he produced the first volume, The Early Years, in 1961. Some of you are familiar with this classic, which is still in print. But here's my favorite piece of American history for the few that haven't heard it.
As the seeds of turmoil flowered and grew, the hastily assembled American army craved a banner they could call their own. A certain Philadelphia seamstress came General George Washington one day in the icy winter of 1777.
Betsy! You in there, Betsy?
Who is it?
Me, George.
Oh, boy. Come on in. Hey!
How's that?
You're tracking snow all over my American rug.
See the flank.
Just a minute. Let me bite the thread off here.
Well, snap it up. Spread it out in your lap there. You, having a little fun at your country's expense here?
Huh? How's that?
Kidding with these colors? Red, white, and blue?
Well, those are the only remnants I had around.
Wait a minute. Stars? I deliberately said polka dots.
Polka?
Stars with stripes? How does that work together, design-wise?
All right, you want to be the big man and put on the thimble, huh?
No, it's...
Then how about you let me run the flag department and you run the army like a nice father of our country, okay?
I know, but look at the colors you chose. The best you could do, I suppose, a peppermint stripe with royal blue, the same as the British colors, toot and a hubble, we tell who sight is. Oh, look at the colors you chose. Why couldn't it have been hues? Lavender overcharged rouge, or possibly some mixed up to exchange the delicate orange bulb for jade instead of the choice that has been made. Why couldn't it have been possibly cinnamon?
Everybody wants to be an art director. Everybody wants to talk shop.
Yeah, well.
Everybody wants to be a blank dissector, changing all my stars to polka dots. Everybody thinks that they're the final.
Can you make one up?
Come on, there's your flag. Take it or leave it.
inspected by number 28.
That's right. You want it on a hanger?
No, I'll just run it up the flagpole and see if anybody's looking.
Okay.
I guess it's better than don't tread on me.
Certainly. Besides, 100 years from now, what the heck difference will it make?
There's a lot of things running through the threads of Stan's material. After release of part one, part two was eagerly anticipated by Freeburg fans, but it was not forthcoming. Though it was written, Stan made arrangements with Broadway producer David Murick to stage it in 1965 and title it Shoot If You Must. Murick had the rights then, but he took a $1 million loss on the musical version of Breakfast at Tiffany's, a real bomb called Holly Go Lightly, and he couldn't produce the show. In 1983, Freeburg was to present a concert version of the show, which covers through World War II and includes attacks on Thomas Edison, Alexander Graham Bell, etc., in Florida at the Burt Reynolds Dinner Theater and also at the Kennedy Center in Washington. But I've not been able to verify this. The most I have is Stan saying, I'm going to do it in 3 months. The follow-up to USA was in 1968, Stan's last commercial release. It was Freeburg Underground, or subtitled Pay Radio, an idea that Freeburg had to bring back radio by selling monthly recordings you'd pick up at the local store. A very brief but high point of this disc was Freeburg's demonstration of things you could do with radio that you couldn't do on television. Here's Stan with an explanation of how he recorded this.
I was asked to point out that when I did this track, I did the demonstration of sound before I put it on the album. So we were in a studio without an audience doing that. And in those days, we didn't have 8-track, you know, multiple track at all. We just had mono. So what we had to do is line up all these mono machines, and the dialogue is on this one, and then this one is the mountain sliding, and this is the splash, and then this is the Royal Canadian Air Force, and there's the whistle of the bomb with the probably hooked onto the splat. And then there's a crowd. Okay, so the guy has to back up all these things to the leader, right? And I'm running along beside the engineer. Like, okay, cue. Oh, too bad, he missed it. He blew it. Okay, stop everything, back all the leaders up, you know. So we did that 74 times. To get this, anyhow, this is how.
Look, you could do things on radio, see, that you couldn't possibly do on television. My sound effects man and I will give you a demonstration right now.
Okay,
people, now when I give you the cue, I want the 500-foot mountain of whipped cream to be shoved into Lake Michigan, which has been drained and filled with hot chocolate. Then the Royal Canadian Air Force will appear overhead towing a 10-ton maraschino cherry, which will be dropped into the whipped cream with the cheering of 25,000 extras. All right, cue the mountain.
This into a commercial or a set of commercials for the Radio Advertising Bureau, which is how many people remember this, but it originally started on the K radio. Not according to Stan. I may be wrong. Today, Stan still lives in a Spanish-style mansion called Stan Simeon in Beverly Hills. When something irks him, he calls the cable news network and offers editorials. He says his idols have been Fred Allen, Jack Benny, E.B. White, and especially S.J. Perlman. In 1967, he planned to write his autobiography, My Funny Life in Advertising and How I Want to Get Out of It. But though Random House has the manuscript, it's yet to be published. It was promised in December, then it was promised in May, appropriately to coincide with my presentation. And as far as I understand from Random House, it's not coming out in the near future. Ernie Kovacs once called Freeburg a multiple incantation of Fred Allen, Don Quixote, and Donald Duck. Freeburg calls himself a communicator. I hope this brief look at his recorded career has shown him to be this and more. As a postscript to this, I learned from Mike Beal the other night, I missed the obituary, that Stan's major voice that you hear through all these pieces is Dawes Butler, who was the gentleman who, with Stan, was responsible for all the voices for Time for Beanie. He passed away last week. I have a few sets of my Freebergography over here, as well as my want list. And if someone can help me find on tape some of the things that we're still looking for, I'd sure appreciate it. Thank you very much.